or have another print disability, which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
Hello, this is Corrine, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the July 29th, 2026 issue of the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Thank you for joining us today. The highlights under business and finance are: Boeing spent another quarter in the red, though its net loss narrowed as it poured more resources into developing new presidential jets and accelerating production of commercial aircraft. The FAA asked airlines to inspect hundreds of Boeing 737 MAX passenger jets for improperly installed cabin seats that could prove dangerous in the case of an emergency. Major U.S. stock indexes ended mixed, with the S&P 500 and Dow rising 0.2% and 1% respectively, and the NASDAQ falling 0.2%. Bank Indonesia Governor Peri Warjio stepped down in a surprise move that is likely to stoke worries about central bank independence in Southeast Asia's largest nation. Apple launched a product leasing program with Klarna that will allow customers to pay monthly for new devices and then return, upgrade, or buy them. Visa logged higher revenue for its latest quarter as consumers continued to spend even in the face of inflationary pressures. CBS News is adding several high-profile journalists to 60 Minutes as new executive producer Nick Bilton reshapes the iconic news magazine. Coca-Cola boosted its earnings outlook for the year after the company's marketing efforts, including its World Cup campaign, helped drive volume. FIFA, soccer's highest governing body, is exploring raising more than $4 billion by selling a stake in a new commercial venture. Visa logged higher revenue for its latest quarter as consumers continue to spend, even in the face of inflationary pressures. PayPal raised its profitability forecast and signaled an openness to a potential takeover deal if an offer came at the right price. Now for the key articles under the worldwide section. Iran launched a surprise ballistic missile attack on American forces in Jordan, a violent escalation that piles new pressure on Trump to renew the war in earnest. Trump and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu met at the White House, navigating a growing rift 5 months after the two launched a war in Iran that has proven far more complex than either imagined. Iran rejected a proposal by Oman, which sits opposite Iran across the Strait of Hormuz, to evenly divide control of the waterway. The Senate confirmed Jay Clayton as Director of National Intelligence, placing a top federal prosecutor at the helm of an agency that underwent staff cuts in recent weeks. The Trump administration plans to end a subsidy program that helped hold down premiums for Medicare drug plans, potentially leaving many seniors to face higher rates for prescription coverage next year. Rescue operations were underway and more than 200,000 people were given evacuation orders after a 6.8 magnitude earthquake struck southern Japan. A cabinet secretary, Trump's niece, and an Oscar-nominated director are among the potential targets of New York City Mayor Zoran Mandani's tax on luxury second homes. A teenager who committed a deadly mass shooting at a high school in Winder, Georgia, in 2024, was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. The Trump administration proposed a way for space companies to skip environmental reviews as the U.S. prepares for a surge in launches in coming years. Confirmed cases in Congo's Ebola outbreak reached 3,262, the country's Ministry of Health said, nearly the number of those tallied in a 2018-20 outbreak. South Korean authorities ordered civilians to evacuate after a suspected white phosphorus leak at a U.S. military base near Seoul. The picture on today's front page shows President Trump and other dignitaries attending a funeral. And that caption reads, "Tributes. President Donald Trump, Vice President J.D. Vance, and members of the cabinet attend the funeral Tuesday for Senator Lindsey Graham at Washington National Cathedral. The South Carolina Republican, a top advisor to Trump on foreign affairs, died July 11th. And that headline, Graham praised as American original. The article, Capitol Pays Last Respects to Graham. Political leaders from Washington and the world bid farewell to Senator. By Maya Davis, Siobhan Hughes, and Richard Rubin. Washington. President Trump called the late Senator Lindsey Graham a respected statesman, giant of the U.S. Senate, and true American original. In a speech eulogizing the influential lawmaker at a funeral at the Washington National Cathedral on Tuesday afternoon. For more than 30 years, nothing of consequence happened in this Capitol without Lindsey Graham knowing about it. No bill became law without Lindsey Graham having a say in it, said Trump. He was a man who gave America the full measure of his good and mighty heart until that heart itself just gave out. There was nobody truly like Lindsey Graham, Trump said. Graham, a South Carolina Republican who was a top advisor to Trump on foreign affairs, is being laid to rest this week. The observances began with a solemn ceremony attended by congressional colleagues and Vice President J.D. Vance in the Capitol Rotunda, followed by a service at the cathedral later in the afternoon. He will be buried in South Carolina on Wednesday. Attendees at the cathedral included cabinet members such as Secretary of State Marco Rubio, Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr., and Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent, and top Trump aides Susie Wiles and Stephen Miller. Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh, whom Graham fiercely defended during his confirmation hearing, had a third row seat. Before the service began, The crowd was transfixed by the sight of Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky in conversation with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Senator Tim Scott, Republican from South Carolina, and former Representative Trey Gowdy, Republican from South Carolina, sat together in a row that included Senators Dick Durbin, Democrat from Illinois, and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, Democrat from New York, some of the dozens of lawmakers who squeezed into the pews. Pennsylvania Senators John Fetterman, a Democrat, and Dave McCormick, a Republican, walked in together. While Democrats have heavily criticized Graham and Trump over the Iran war, many had been partners with Graham over the years, traveling on foreign trips with him, or, in the case of Durbin, attempting to strike deals on immigration policy. During his speech, Trump also acknowledged that he and Graham had once been political rivals in the 2016 presidential race. Lindsay and I did not exactly get off to the best of starts running against each other, Trump said. He then recalled a stunt in which he gave out Graham's personal cell phone number during a 2015 campaign appearance. The president proceeded to read the number again Tuesday to laughter in the cathedral. If anyone wants to give it a shot, the president said. Trump also reiterated his support for Senator Darlene Graham, whom the president endorsed to serve out the late senator's term, and then urged to run for a full 6-year term. Darlene Graham was seated in the front row. I have no doubt that he's looking down today, beaming with pride that his sister's a senator, Trump said. Fox News host Sean Hannity followed Trump with his own remarks praising Graham and referenced Graham's efforts to push Trump to confront Iran while calling for the U.S. and allies to finish the job. Lindsay had moral clarity, Hannity said. There can be no path to peace until evil is defeated. Other articles from the front page follow. Iran launches missile attack on U.S. forces. Surprise strike marks strategy shift for Tehran. Projectiles are all intercepted. By Michael Amann, Laura Sigelman, and Shelby Holliday. Iran launched a surprise ballistic missile attack on American forces in Jordan. A U.S. official said, a violent escalation that piles new pressure on President Trump to renew the war in earnest. The missiles were all successfully intercepted, the U.S. military said. But the assault raised the prospect that American forces would have to respond, just as negotiations to reopen the Strait of Hormuz and eventually jumpstart broader peace talks were picking up speed. The assault marked a shift for Iran, which until now has generally fired on U.S. forces in retaliation for American airstrikes on its own territory. With the unprompted missile attack, Iran showed it is willing to take the fight to the U.S. on its own terms in an attempt to force Trump's hand. Shortly after the Iranian strikes on Jordan, the U.S. military announced that U.S. and Saudi jet fighters had launched strikes in Iraq on Tuesday against Iran-backed groups that the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps had previously directed to attack American troops and Saudi energy infrastructure. Those attacks against U.S. forces weren't successful, U.S. Central Command said. Hours before Iran's barrage, Trump said Tuesday the U.S. would restart strikes against Iran if a ceasefire deal couldn't be reached. They know I'm going to do that if they don't make a deal, he told Fox and Friends on Tuesday. The bridges are going to be gone, literally in less than, I would say, in 2 hours. Most of the bridges, the major bridges, will all be gone, and the power plants in 1 day, he said. He said that Iran had agreed to give up its nuclear weapons ambitions, but needed to make it formal, he said. I just want, very simply, they cannot have a nuclear weapon. Very simple, and they've agreed to that. Essentially, we have to get them to, you know, make it formal. Iran launched the attack 5 months after the war began on February 28th, when the U.S. and Israel began airstrikes that killed a swath of the Islamic Republic's leadership, including its top ruler, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. The barrage capped several weeks of wobbly diplomacy, during which the U.S. and Iran agreed in June to end hostilities. But disputes over how to reopen the Strait of Hormuz, through which 20% of global oil production flowed before the war, prompted Trump to order almost 2 weeks of airstrikes on Iran this month. Trump paused those strikes on Friday to give peace talks a chance. On Tuesday, Iran said it had rejected an Omani plan for resuming traffic in the Strait of Hormuz, pushing its own proposal that would give Tehran more control over shipping in the strategic waterway. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Trump turns up heat on RFK Jr. to cut back on childhood vaccines, by Liz Esley White, Washington. At a May lunch at the president's golf course in Northern Virginia, President Trump asked Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. why he wasn't doing more to probe the alleged connection between vaccines and autism, according to people familiar with the matter. The health secretary had the yips, Trump told Kennedy, according to one of the people. Kennedy was taken aback, even though he has long been known to be skeptical of vaccinations. He had been asked by White House political advisors to tone down his vaccine efforts ahead of the midterms, the people said. Now it was the commander-in-chief who was pushing to make the study of vaccines and autism more of a priority. The president steers nearly every conversation with his health secretary back to the issue, some of the people said. Chief among the president's desires, do more to reduce the number of shots that federal guidelines recommend for children, according to people familiar with the matter. They said the president hopes to then see autism rates drop, even if any such effect could take years. The president has made clear he thinks he has given Kennedy enough time and is disappointed the health secretary hasn't accomplished more, the people said. Meta's AI spending binge runs into rising debt costs, by Peter Rudiger, Jack Pitcher, and Anna Maria Andriotis. Meta Platforms is counting on Wall Street to pick up the tab for an artificial intelligence spending spree. It picked a time when lenders' wallets are starting to feel light. A borrowing binge this year for big tech companies is giving debt investors fatigue and pushing up the cost of capital across the industry. Lenders on Monday demanded higher yields on bonds from a new data center project in El Paso, Texas, leased by Meta, compared with a similar project last year. Concerns about more AI-adjacent debt coming, especially after an aggressive spending forecast from Alphabet's Google last week, sparked a sell-off in tech stocks and helped push down prices of bonds from companies like Microsoft and Amazon.com. The supply of new bonds this year from AI companies reached $270 billion in early July, almost double what was raised in all of 2025, according to Bank of America Global Research. Despite the investor indigestion, the data center boom looks poised to create even more new debt, even if it ends up being more expensive, because no player wants to risk falling behind in the AI race. Meta executives have told bankers and fund managers that it will need to raise hundreds of billions of dollars to support its AI build-out and is in talks with other firms like Blackstone for additional funds, people familiar with the matter said. Meanwhile, NVIDIA is in talks with OpenAI to provide a $250 billion backstop to help finance the construction of a data center project in Ohio, the Wall Street Journal reported Sunday. The market is expecting the build to continue, said Neha Hoda, head of U.S. credit strategy at the Bank of America. Just at a higher price point. Underground Reactor Splits Rural Kansas by Chris Maher and Jennifer Hiller. Parsons, Kansas. Residents of this sleepy farming outpost agree on many things, but whether to put an experimental nuclear reactor a mile deep in the granite beneath their town isn't one of them. Elected officials and some others see a chance to create jobs and lure data centers and manufacturers to a rural patch where the economy has been flatter than the surrounding cornfields. Another group is effectively saying, not under my backyard. I put $125,000 into my house, and now a nuclear reactor is coming to town, said Gerald Johnson, an IT professional who planned to retire in Parsons. I can't think of a worse idea. No one has tried operating a commercial nuclear reactor deep underground until now. The so-called gravity reactor is the creation of Liz Muller and her father, Richard Muller, emeritus professor of physics at the University of California, Berkeley, and an inventor. They founded Deep Fission, a three-year-old startup that has raised around $150 million in the past year, including $40 million last month, through an initial public offering, largely to fund the work in Parsons. Parsons, population 9,600, sits about midway between Kansas City and Tulsa, Oklahoma. Deep Fission drilled a first test hole this spring on 100 acres at a mostly overgrown industrial park dotted with old munition bunkers just outside the town. On a recent day, Maurice LaFontaine, Deep Fission's senior engineering director, showed off pink-flecked granite retrieved from the company's first test hole and joked that the billion-dollar old rock would make a nice countertop. An empty steel canister sat on a clear drill pad, waiting to go down a second hole this year. The plan is to send another one loaded with nuclear fuel into a third hole to heat water a mile underground and generate electricity on the surface in 2027 or 2028, an astonishingly short time frame by industry standards. The project is riding momentum from the Trump administration's efforts to usher in a nuclear renaissance by streamlining regulations and offering the industry billions of dollars in loans and fuel supply chain investments. Executive orders President Trump signed last year aim to quadruple America's nuclear power generation by 2050, a steep climb given that construction in the industry has slowed to a crawl for the last three decades. Nuclear generates about a fifth of U.S. electricity. The renewed interest comes amid soaring electricity demand, much of it driven by data centers for artificial intelligence. Deep Fission's project is one of 11 in an Energy Department pilot program designed to build and test small, advanced reactors to pave the way for commercial use. Participating companies can construct reactors outside a traditional national laboratory setting and use expedited procedures for environmental reviews. It's allowing us to develop a first reactor within a time frame that had been unthinkable previously, said Liz Muller, Deep Fission's chief executive. Leaving the front page for other articles, Medicare drug plan subsidy will end, by Anna Wild Matthews. The Trump administration plans to end a subsidy program that helped hold down premiums for Medicare drug plans, a move that could leave many seniors facing higher rates for their prescription coverage next year. The move will eliminate a program that is giving insurance companies an estimated $3.6 billion in subsidies this year to blunt increases in premiums for the Medicare prescription plans known as Part D. The program will end after 2026, according to administration officials. High drug costs are a perennial issue, especially for seniors on fixed incomes, and health care affordability is expected to be a focus in the midterm elections. Roughly 25 million people have Part D plans, and they will learn about their 2027 rates in the fall. A Trump administration official said the extra subsidies encouraged insurers to raise rates, knowing the government would pick up the extra cost. He said the subsidies weren't needed, and other policies that help hold down Part D costs also remain in place. We are stabilizing the market, so this bailout is no longer needed, said Mehmet Oz, the administrator of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, in a posting on social media. Apple launches Klarna leasing program, by Joseph Diavilla. Apple launched a new product leasing program with Klarna that will allow customers to pay monthly for new devices and then return, upgrade, or buy them. The program, dubbed Apple Upgrade, will offer 12 and 24 month leasing options for iPhone and Apple Watch, and 24 and 36 month terms for Mac and iPad. Klarna, the buy now, pay later company, will provide the leasing options. The announcement comes a month after Apple raised prices on some of its devices because of soaring memory and chip storage cost. Leasing program prices start at $17.99 a month for iPhone, $11.99 for Apple Watch, $24.99 for Mac, and $11.99 for iPad, Apple said Tuesday. At the end of the lease agreement, customers can return the product, get an upgrade, or buy the product for a one-time fee. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. From the editorial page, the Lindsey Graham example. Will anyone take his place as an advocate for U.S. principles abroad? Tuesday's memorial ceremonies for Senator Lindsey Graham were a rare moment of amity in today's bitter politics of Washington. The South Carolina Republican was celebrated for his sense of humor, his bipartisan engagement, and for being at the center of the political action. For more than 30 years, nothing of consequence happened in this Capitol without Lindsey Graham knowing about it. No bill became law without Lindsey Graham having a say in it, President Trump said about his friend in his fitting eulogy. He was a man who gave America the full measure of his good and mighty heart until that heart itself just gave out. Graham was all of those things. He was, in that sense, a politician in the best sense of the word, engaged in the debates of the day, passionate in making a difference with the power he had. He cared about using that power, not merely keeping it. But his memory shouldn't pass without recalling the principles he fought for. Above all, he believed that America is a force for good in the world. Perhaps in part because of his time overseas in the Air Force, he believed U.S. military, economic, and diplomatic power could be marshaled to expand freedom in the world in the American national interest. In that cause, he was crucial to the defense of Ukraine against Russia's marauding and Israel against Iran and its terrorist proxy militias. There aren't many current U.S. senators who would draw the Prime Minister of Israel and the President of Ukraine to the memorial services. It's a shame Graham didn't live to see his Russia sanctions bill pass the Senate, or see Israel and Saudi Arabia normalize relations, two of his great causes. Graham quipped in his final days that he couldn't die now because he was close to achieving both goals. At the current froth moment, the country needs men and women like Lindsey Graham to step forward. Any volunteers? The FDA deep state strikes back. Staff twist reviews to kill therapies for melanoma and muscular dystrophy. The Food and Drug Administration bureaucracy can be as combative and entrenched as any in Washington. This week, the agency is trying to sink promising new therapies for late-stage melanoma and Duchenne muscular dystrophy. President Trump pushed out Marty McCary and his deputy Vinay Prasad this spring, in large part because they had scuttled treatments for life-threatening and rare diseases. We've chronicled over the past year how the agency repeatedly moved the goalpost for approving treatments and nitpicked trial results. The FDA, under Acting Commissioner Kyle Diamantis, in recent months appeared to be turning around. The agency is considering many treatments rejected by the previous regime and has scheduled public hearings with outside experts to review medicines. Alas, it now appears that FDA bureaucrats who share Dr. Prasad's hostility toward innovative treatments are digging in. The FDA this week released briefing documents prepared by staff ahead of advisory meetings for Replimune's melanoma immunotherapy Thursday and Capricor Therapeutics cell therapy for Duchenne Wednesday that resurrect the agency's specious reasons for previously rejecting the treatments. This is a nasty effort to influence the outside experts, many of whom aren't intimately familiar with the treatments or diseases. Consider Replimune's RP1, which the agency's original review panel recommended for approval after its trial showed that a third of metastatic patients who received the treatment after the cancer progressed on other immunotherapies went into remission. Tumors vanished in 1 of 6. Melanoma specialists heralded the results as unprecedented, yet Dr. Prasad overruled the staff. When his rejection sparked an uproar among patients and physicians, he selected a new staff panel for political cover. No surprise, the panel agreed with him and concocted pretexts to kill the treatment. For instance, the staff opined that many biopsies had zapped the tumors. If only biopsies had such miraculous effects. This week's briefing document repeats such absurdities and manipulates the data to claim the drug doesn't work. Staff excluded from the efficacy calculation patients who had RP1 injected in all of their tumors, but only from the numerator and not denominator. This arithmetic trick reduced RP1's response rate from 33.6% to 15.7%. The staff acknowledged that patients who received and benefited from RP1 lived a median of 30.6 months without cancer progressing versus 4.4 months on their prior immunotherapy. You don't need a high school diploma to discern this as a treatment benefit. Yet the FDA said it found this comparison to be uninterpretable. About half of patients with metastatic melanoma will get worse on first-time immunotherapies within a year, at which point they have scant options. That doesn't concern FDA staffers who persist in their insistence that Replimune should have run a randomized controlled trial that would have taken years and been unethical because some desperate patients would have received a placebo. Meanwhile, the agency last summer scuttled Capricor's treatment for patients with advanced Duchenne muscular dystrophy because it claimed its randomized controlled trial for patients was too small to determine definitively that the treatment worked. Capricor resubmitted its application in February with results from a larger placebo-controlled trial of mostly wheelchair-bound boys. This trial showed the treatment slowed decline in patients' ability to use their arms by 54% and weakening of their cardiac muscles by 91%. The staff accused Capricor of twisting the data. The FDA claims Capricor changed the methodology for its planned statistical analysis after the trial began, so its results should be ignored. Capricor says it adjusted the methodology after expanding the number of patients in its trial based on feedback it had earlier received from the FDA. Capricor also says it revised the methodology before unblinding patients and knowing the test results. Never mind, the FDA claims patients in the trial weren't truly blinded because side effects would have caused them to suspect they were receiving a placebo. FDA says this would somehow have resulted in less cardiac atrophy on MRIs. Really? The company last year complained that it was blindsided by the FDA rejection after having followed the agency's guidance. Is the bureaucracy retaliating now because the company spoke out? The FDA has long had a bureaucratic culture of control that doesn't abide public criticism. Dr. Prasad made it worse by driving out division leaders and staffers who didn't share his anti-industry dogmatism. The result is a leadership vacuum. We hope the experts this week aren't swayed by the bureaucracy's kill shots, which underscore why the FDA needs permanent leaders who share the president's right to try principles. From the opinion pages, Hollywood's rule of lawfare. Attorneys general wield antitrust law as a weapon against Trump and MAGA. By Homan W. Jenkins, Jr. Unfortunately for David Ellison, his father is as rich as Larry Ellison, not as rich as Elon Musk. And still, Mr. Musk had to be sued into completing his acquisition of Twitter, a fate that may yet befall Mr. Ellison's faltering deal to buy the Warner Brothers studio and TV business and marry it with his smaller Paramount studio business. What the two transactions really have in common? The acquirers positioned their acquisitions as instruments in the wars between Donald Trump and his enemies, between the camps of woke and MAGA. Mr. Musk framed his pursuit of Twitter in terms of principle, restoring free speech. But the furor over Twitter's alleged role in 2016 and 2020 elections was hardly far from every mind. Mr. Ellison cited no principle. He played up his connections to the Trump administration in a politicized appeal to Warner shareholders. They'd get a quicker, sure payout than if they went with rival bidder Netflix. He underlined his bona fides by remaking CBS News in a less woke direction. He hired Makan Delrahim, the antitrust chief who sandbagged a deal for the same assets. The buyer then was AT&T under the first Trump administration. The courts would eventually toss Mr. Delrahim's bogus case, but not before the delay helped torpedo AT&T's business strategy. Message to Warner shareholders, go with Netflix and expect the same. All this isn't only grotesque in an America where you would hope regulatory approvals would be granted or denied on the merits. In a large irony, Mr. Delrahim's disingenuous antitrust claims, which essentially pretended away the streaming revolution, have resurfaced even more idiotically 9 years later, to sandbag the deal he now champions. The reason is a play by 12 Democratic state attorneys general to thwart Warner Paramount after it was approved by competition authorities in every relevant market in the world. On one level, yes, what goes around has come around. Today's attorneys generals can't really believe their antitrust claims. They notice, however, that the deal would bring together CNN and CBS News, never mind that news is financially a pimple and the last thing the Ellisons care about. In liberal America, and especially California, where Attorney General Rob Bonta is leading the charge, the effort is read as fighting back against the meganization of the news as the midterms approach. However obvious it might be that the Ellisons' incentives would change instantly when the deal closes, from seeking to cultivate Mr. Trump to cultivating liberal Hollywood. Nevertheless, a judge was impressed, or feigned to be, with an obviously disingenuous antitrust claim. There will likely be a trial. Laughably, it will turn on whether the two studios, both flailing and laid low by the streaming revolution, are merging to monopolize the two businesses that streaming has made least coveted, cable TV and theatrical film distribution. The court proceedings will be a sideshow to the real issue. The Ellisons are in a deep hole because of the price they paid in the bidding war with Netflix for the potentially promising Warner assets. The Ellisons also agreed to a ticking fee that will drive up the price by $7 million a day if the deal doesn't close by late September, which it likely won't. Thus, the incentive for the attorneys general to bring a case and drag it out no matter how meritless. In one way, the uber politicization of this major Hollywood transaction is overdetermined. It didn't begin with Messrs. Trump and Del Harim's crass treatment of the AT&T deal. It didn't begin with President Obama's big footing of a supposedly independent FCC on behalf of Netflix in 2014, which I'm sure had no relation to the production deal he later signed with Netflix. One factor has been the remarkable transformation of the once inconspicuous state attorney general's job. Starting in the late 90s, Holders began intruding themselves noisily into national hot-button debates, often in cahoots with their trial bar donors. Antitrust, to boot, has long been a politicized charade. Even so, California's Mr. Bonta is kidding himself when he claims to be standing up for Hollywood jobs. Nothing can stop the tides of economic and technological change. Best for workers would be the regulatory quagmire ending quickly, so the two studios can return to investing in content. Ultimately, the only way to pay down their debt and create jobs. You'll see what's really driving Mr. Bonta and colleagues the day after November 3rd, when they lose all interest in their case and hand it over to their lowest interns. Here's one reason to regret an eroding rule of law. Puny, short-term interest inserting themselves to undermine long-term risk-taking, which the Ellison deal certainly represents, and then some, as did the AT&T deal before it. The only good news for American capitalism, the U.S. experiment in liberty, individual rights, and market freedom is likely to survive for now because the rest of the world is heading in the wrong direction even faster. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the Wall Street Journal on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. The answer to academic achievement gap is obvious, by Jason L. Riley. Don't let anyone convince you that we don't know how to shrink America's persistent academic achievement gap. The solutions are staring right at us. The issue isn't know-how, it's a lack of political will. The people in charge of public education have chosen to place job security above the well-being of students. Children attend schools that have been failure factories since before they were born, and in some cases before their parents were born. Yet these schools remain in operation because they provide solid middle-class employment opportunities for adults. They continue to underperform because they reward teacher seniority over competence. More money is the answer, we're often told. Yet New York City, home to the nation's largest public school system, spent $40 billion on its schools in 2024, up from $24 billion a decade earlier. That works out to $36,000 a student, which is more than double the national average of $17,600. The return on this enormous taxpayer investment is a travesty. According to a new report published by the Success Academy Charter School Network, in nearly half of the city's schools, most students flunked standardized tests in math and reading last year. The dysfunction starts in the early grades and worsens as children are shuffled through the system. More than a third of students, 34%, are relegated to an elementary school where most fail math, reading, or both, as are nearly half of the middle school students, 49%. Later, 62% attend a high school where a majority of children can't pass a Regents exam in math or reading. These are not schools teetering at the edge of success, reads the report, which cites publicly available state and local education data. They are schools that have been massively failing, persistently, systemically, and at staggering public expense for years and in many cases for decades. Success Academy was founded 20 years ago by Eva Moskowitz, a former chairman of the New York City Council's Education Committee. Ms. Moskowitz has a well-earned reputation as a tireless champion of school choice, and her high-achieving public charter school network gives lie to the claim that outside forces, poverty, racism, broken families, are primarily to blame for lagging performance in the classroom. At these schools, there are no excuses, and the achievement gap has all but disappeared. Success Academy students are disproportionately Black, Hispanic, and low income. Yet they outperform their peers in traditional public schools and students from wealthier and predominantly white school districts. In 2025, Success Academy ranked first in math and second in reading in New York State exam results out of more than 700 school districts, and 100% of its students were accepted to a four-year college for the ninth year in a row. Critics claim the better outcomes result from cherry-picking better students with more motivated parents at home. But charter schools choose students by lottery, not based on academic ability. And because charter school applications far outnumber the available slots, most of the students with more motivated parents wind up in traditional public schools. Studies that compare charter school students with their peers who applied and were rejected consistently show that charters produce better outcomes. Earlier this month, New York City released data on incoming ninth graders who received admission offers from the city's elite public high schools, where students are selected based on the results of a three-hour exam known as the Specialized High School Admissions Test. Around 80% of the offers went to Asian and white students, even though Black and Hispanic children comprise 62% of all public school students. At Stuyvesant High School, which is considered the most selective of the elite schools, only 3 of 777 offers went to Black students and 21 went to Hispanic students. Those results have led to renewed calls to eliminate the entrance exam or expand the criteria for admissions to elite schools, but a far more constructive approach would be to lift the current cap on charter schools. The problem is test preparation, not testing. And anyone serious about increasing Black and Hispanic enrollment might consider the record of high-performing charters. According to a spokeswoman, Success Academy had a 21% acceptance rate for the specialized high schools this year versus a citywide average just over 15%. That's not unusual. And the acceptance rate for the school's Black and Hispanic students is typically double the citywide average. If policymakers are looking for a way to juice racial and ethnic diversity without lowering admission standards, the obvious move would be to overturn laws backed by teachers' unions that restrict school choice. Big labor will whine if charter options expand because most aren't unionized. But I'm guessing the 163,000 children sitting on charter school wait list in New York City couldn't care less. Comparing interest rates from last week to now, a money market annual yield still remains 0.44%. A 5-year CD was 1.73, now 1.72%. A 30-year fixed mortgage was 6.62%, now 6.76%. A 15-year fixed mortgage was 6.06%, now 6.15%. Jumbo mortgages were 6.72%, now 6.77%. A 5-year adjustable mortgage was 5.99%, now 5.96%. A new car loan, 48 months, was 6.96%, now 6.97%. You've been listening to the July 29th issue of the Wall Street Journal, read by